name is Nicole Letterman. I am a second-year psychiatry resident at the University of New Mexico Department of Psychiatry. Thank you to the CIT COS team for allowing me to present on a topic that I'm personally very interested in. Presentation entitled Psychiatric Emergencies, Who Gets Hospitalized and Who Gets Discharged? And you know, a common question being, you know, what happens when law enforcement brings patients to the emergency department? So we're hoping to clarify some of those questions here today. Learning objectives listed right here. So this is our lovely facility right outside of the University of New Mexico. This is our psychiatric emergency service. And one point that's really important to identify is that the psychiatric emergency facility is actually in a distinct location compared to the main emergency department. So if a patient comes in with, you know, a medical emergency, it's really important that they be transported to the other emergency department. And just a very brief introduction to the many different staff and providers that you'll see in the emergency department here. We have a team that works very closely together in PES, being, you know, clerks that check patients in, security, mental health techs, nurses, physicians, and mid-level providers. And pictured here are Dr. Faja, Dr. Martin, two of our medical directors here. So we all work very closely together to ensure the safety and health of our patients. And so this was actually taken from a study done over in Rhode Island, asking 82 different patients the question, you know, what is the main reason you came here today to the psychiatric emergency room? Among the most common answers are, you know, feeling depressed, feeling suicidal, other reasons being for alcohol, drug abuse, detoxification purposes, seeking admission to the hospital, and kind of more towards the bottom being, you know, my psychiatrist told me to come here, I need to get evaluated, I need, you know, medication. You know, so what happens when a patient comes to the psychiatric emergency room? The clerks check the patient in, secure belongings, vital signs are taken, the initial triage process is undergone to determine whether or not the patient is safe to be kept in the lobby versus needing to come back. And then the nurse evaluates the patient, and then, you know, the provider will go ahead and evaluate the patient at that time as well. And so this slide is a little bit wordy, but these are some of the items that we do pay, you know, very close attention to when deciding whether or not, you know, a patient needs to come in to the hospital. Looking at the fixed and demographic risk factors, short-term, current, and protective risk factors. And so just to highlight some of these, you know, men, more than women are more likely to commit suicide, Caucasians, Native Americans, and then looking at age groups, you know, adolescents and the elderly are more at risk. If a patient is separated, if a patient has an underlying psychiatric disorder, the number one risk factor for acute risk of suicide is the presence of a previous suicide attempt, and especially if the patient has attempted within, you know, the past 12 months, if there's a close associate suicide, a history of abuse, chronic medical comorbidities. And then some of the more short-term risk factors, has the patient undergone a recent loss in the family? Has the patient been discharged within a psychiatric facility within the past 12 months, which, you know, seems kind of counterintuitive, but it's actually, you know, the structure and the organization within the psychiatric facility that really helps the patient in the acute crisis, but when they're discharged, they go back to their home environment and a somewhat chaotic place, which actually kind of puts them more at risk for future harm. You know, current risk factors being, you know, agitation, anxiety, difficulty with sleep, living alone, presence of firearms or other means, and then, know, protective risk factor? Are they future oriented in their language? Do they have kids, strong social support, and all of these other items here? So what's really important is
what a future oriented language would be.
Yeah, of course. So if a patient comes into the emergency department and they say, you know, I really want to hurt myself, but I need to get to my job the next morning. So they're talking about an event in the future. Does that make sense?
Yes. And sorry, this is Niels Rosamund. And generally for it to be really protective or more protective, it should be positive forward thinking. So if I just say, oh yeah, I have work tomorrow, that's not protective. But if I say, gosh, I love my job, I can't wait to get there, which all you guys say, then that's protective.
Oh, no, we're in trouble.
Yeah, and a lot of the times we will find, you know, patients mention, you know, their partners or their children and needing to, you know, stay alive for those reasons as well. So those are some pretty common things. And please do chime in if anything doesn't make sense or if anything is not clear. And so this point at the bottom here, determination of acute risk and chronic risk. You know, while a patient may present in crisis, that's more so referring to the acute risk. So if a patient does present with any number of these fixed or demographic risk factors, being things that we cannot change, the risk will kind of remain generally elevated, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they always need to come into the hospital. So that's something that we do pay attention to as well.
What would be a chronic risk? I'm just asking because these are terms we don't typically use in law enforcement.
Sure. So some items that will kind of like elevate the patient's, so chronic being kind of like long-term risk. So mostly looking at acute or short-term versus chronic or long-term risk too. So mostly looking at these fixed and demographic risk factors, things that we, you know, can't really change. So the age of the patient, the gender, the sex of the patient, have they had a previous suicide attempt? All of these things may elevate the patient's chronic risk. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So who gets admitted to the hospital? You know, the language that's frequently used is, are they in immediate danger to themselves or others? Are they actively suicidal, actively homicidal? And then when looking at these two points, there's three main things that we look at in addition to kind of just overall being suicidal. Are they actively or passively suicidal? So do they have a plan? So a patient may come in and say, you know, I want to hurt myself. And then we would go on and ask them, so have you thought about how you would go ahead and do that? And they would say, no, not really. It's just a thought that I've had kind of once a day when I wake up in the morning. You know, that would be more of an example of passive suicidality, whereas a patient who, say, is brought in by law enforcement, kind of walking on the edge of a bridge, who says, you know, I wanted to kill myself, I wanted to jump off the bridge, I fully intended on doing so, that would be somebody who's actively suicidal, who we would be kind of more concerned about. And kind of those same line of events go towards homicidality as well. And these three items here, mania, psychosis, and concern for grave passive neglect, these are items that not necessarily guarantee admission, but certainly things that we do look at and that we do see pretty frequently. Mania being a clinical condition that's indicative that the patient has underlying bipolar disorder, in which their mood may present as very, you know, elevated or happy. They don't need a lot of sleep. Or on the contrary, they may present as very irritable and being very homicidal as well. Somebody who's actively psychotic, so an individual who is unable to care for themselves, in the language that we use is grave passive neglect. And also a patient who presents with very poor insight and judgment, being that they're not very aware if they have an underlying psychiatric disorder and they're not making good decisions. So when looking at whether or not a patient needs to come to the hospital, we think about whether or not they will benefit from treatment and whether or not this is the least restrictive means. So would they be better served at an outpatient setting primarily?
I have a question about,
yes,
this is Karen with CIU. When you were talking about having a plan for suicide versus if they're feeling suicidal and thinking about it, does that mean they would not be hospitalized if they don't have a plan?
So it's kind of taken on a case-by-case basis. So if a patient's telling me that they're, you know, kind of just thinking about it and it's, you know, more, we would look at the timeline as well. So if it's kind of like increasing in frequency, so they're thinking about it more, they're starting to think about a plan, they have maybe rehearsal behaviors, they've been taking the gun in their home and holding it up to their head. You know, those are things that we would kind of consider more so more dangerous than somebody who's just kind of waking up and thinking about suicide. You know, because we have tons and tons and tons of thoughts every single day. And it's whether or not you're acting on those thoughts or if those thoughts are changing that we more so pay attention to.
And I add one to you. Matt Sam from APD, could you talk a little bit more about what perceived benefit from treatment? Because we have a misunderstanding sometimes. I think we bring someone in under a state statute that gives us the right, because in our opinion, they're a danger to themselves or others, but then they're not admitted. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes we have a misunderstanding on that. So what would be that someone that would maybe not benefit from treatment that you see often? Or maybe not often, but frequently.
Often and frequently? Just a little and
small. Just a little small amount.
Sure. So, you know, really, really good examples. Say we have a kiddo with developmental disability or underlying ADHD, and this is illustrated in one of the cases later. But a kid who's been getting into fights with their siblings, or saying that they're gonna, you know, hurt their siblings, hurt their parents, they're gonna bang their head on the wall. You know, of course, we do want to take these on a case-by-case basis. But you know, somebody who needs to come in is they're not necessarily gonna benefit, because it's more outpatient behavioral planning. So it kind of depends on what each person's underlying clinical condition is and what the, you know, expected treatment is. A lot of what we do see at the University of New Mexico is, you know, patients who need medication management. So if somebody has, you know, an underlying psychiatric diagnosis, being a lot of schizophrenia, a lot of bipolar, and they need their medications adjusted, that's somebody who would, you know, benefit from treatment. Somebody who's acutely intoxicated and in the throes of their intoxication make threatening remarks that they're gonna hurt themselves or hurt someone else, not necessarily going to benefit from admission to the hospital, more so benefit from a brief observation period, kind of allowing the substance to pass through and then, you know, giving them the space to return to their mental clarity.
I agree with everything she's saying. This is Niels Rosenbaum, and to expand on that, some of the most common ones that people don't get admitted for are personality disorders, because sometimes personality disorders can in fact get worse in the hospital. Mm-hmm. So you're admitted and you start acting out, and you're not going to change your fundamental personality. So if I'm sort of chronically suicidal in a way that I maybe use to get attention or manipulate people, and I'm brought to the hospital, the cop won't know that because they don't know the patient. Comes to the hospital, and if they are admitted, they can just disrupt the entire unit, and it's bad for everybody. So that would be an example of not benefiting from the treatment.
And there are some cases, you know, at the end of the presentation that will just better illustrate that point. But kind of moving on to what some of the goals of hospitalization are, you know, primarily safety, stabilization, you know, evaluating for any underlying psychiatric disorder, managing medications, and then along with those things, providing individual, group, psychotherapies and things of that nature as well. And just a very brief point on psychiatry and the law. A lot of the times law enforcement will bring in patients who have been issued a certificate for evaluation. So if, I know in the state of New Mexico, if a provider is really concerned about, you know, the patient's safety, the patient's well-being, say a patient's a family member has called the provider and said, you know, I'm really worried about so-and-so. They've been locked in their house for 2 weeks, not eating, not sleeping. I went and checked in on them and there's been cockroaches crawling all over the patient. They're not grooming appropriately. They're not leaving their house. A provider can then issue a certificate for evaluation, necessitating that the patient come in for evaluation at the emergency department. And so that doesn't necessarily always mean that the patient will be admitted, but it does mean that somebody is concerned enough about the patient to have them, you know, kind of taken a closer look at. And then kind of moving on here, when looking at a patient's legal status while in the hospital, they can either come in voluntarily on their own accord saying that they're agreeable or they're amenable to receiving treatment, or they can be put on an involuntary hold. So if a provider is concerned enough about the patient's safety and they're not agreeable, we can put a 7-day hold on the patient, after which point they're guaranteed a court date, at which point the court commissioner is responsible for whether or not the patient will be admitted to the hospital. And that's kind of a very brief overview of a very complex topic, but worth mentioning at the very least. So who gets discharged from PES? A very important point is patients that are medically unstable. So patients that, you know, may come into the emergency department and, you know, their vital signs are unstable, or they have underlying medical conditions that, you know, we're unable to monitor appropriately if they need intravenous access, fluids, things of that nature. Kind of more pertinent to law enforcement, patients who are intoxicated. A lot of the times we're very uncomfortable handling these patients in PES. So say they're drunk, or they've just injected heroin or, you know, spice, and any of these substances that that they may have taken, we would send them to the medical emergency room. So if there's any underlying suspicion that a patient is actively intoxicated, you know, a good point would be to kind of steer them towards the medical emergency room rather than the psychiatric emergency room, which, you know, ideally the two facilities would be kind of closer together, but there is this time lapse when patients do come in to see us. And so who else gets discharged? Kind of as we discussed before, patients who have passive suicidal ideation without, you know, any intent or plan, kind of more so thinking about suicide rather than actively intending on going through with it. If they have an outpatient appointment, you know, within the next week or two, so they're going to be seen by the regular provider, we would more likely discharge them versus if, you know, say they recently moved from another state, or they're found, you know, off of a bus and nobody's going to be seeing them, we'd be, you know, more concerned about them. If they're seeking rehabilitation services for substances, you know, we would discharge them because we do not provide that service at the University of New Mexico. And so if they're searching for a new provider, or if they're looking for medication refills, you know, we don't refill medications out of the emergency room. Or if they do have, you know, this word chronic that I've referred to earlier, chronic psychosis, so kind of long-term psychosis. And I can clarify that in that, you know, a lot of patients, you know, maybe living independently, functioning independently, you know, sleeping, eating, taking care of themselves, but they may have, you know, some delusions. They may have, you know, the idea that somebody is out to get them, or they may be paranoid that somebody is watching them. But are they able to function independently? You know, that's not necessarily somebody that we would bring into the hospital. That's, you know, over if they're demonstrating these behaviors over a longer time course. So what are some common interventions that we would do in a psychiatric emergency room? You know, providing medication to stabilize the patient, you know, being antipsychotic or neuroleptic medications, anxiolytic medication, benzodiazepines, providing supportive psychotherapy, crisis counseling, just simply giving, you know, the patient a safe space to tell their story and, you know, to provide supportive psychotherapy. A common term in the emergency room is, you know, metabolize to freedom. And what does that mean? That means, you know, giving the patient a space.
Oh. It's like, yeah, it's going to be our new logo.
Metabolize to freedom!
Giving the patient a safe space to allow the substance to pass through. MTF is commonly seen on the board, MTF.
Bringing that in. We're taking that into police world now.
There you go. Giving them an observation period or admitting them, you know, to the hospital. And kind of as I've mentioned before, some common, you know, outpatient services that are not best addressed in an emergency room being, you know, detoxification, diagnostic tests, CTs, CAT scans, MRIs, you know, lab tests, medication prescriptions, outside referrals, and family therapy. These are services, you know, that we don't provide in the emergency room. So kind of a couple of key questions here that you can think about whether or not, you know, a patient should be brought to PDS. You know, is the patient in acute danger to himself or others? And, you know, clearly that question can be like very subjective, but, you know, a question that you need to ask yourself. Does the patient have a severe mental illness that is, you know, otherwise not being treated? Or does the patient not have an outside provider that, you know, can evaluate them? Is there evidence of intoxication? Kind of as I alluded to before, the medical emergency room would be a better fit in that case. And is there an intervention that is least restrictive that would provide, you know, equal benefit to the patient as well? So I have some key questions to think about. And, you know, interventions in the field, kind of just to hone in on some of these key points, inquiring about outpatient follow-up, medication adherence, history of violence, has the patient been recently incarcerated, you know, proper identification of coping strategies and social support, are there family members on the scene? One thing that's really helpful is if we're able to get phone numbers for outside family members so that we can kind of gather additional information. And then, as always, you know, providing a non-judgmental approach and support and, you know, validating the patient's concern. Okay. And so we have about 8 cases here, and I realize that getting through all of them may be a little bit ambitious, but I did want to, you know, provide a number of, know, different common presentations that we get in the emergency room, and, you know, kind of take you all through, you know, my thought process and give you a space to ask any clarifying questions or comments on any of these cases. And so a very common one is, and I use a lot of abbreviations here, I apologize, a 32-year-old female with a history of alcohol use disorder brought in by ambulance to the emergency department with a blood alcohol of over 200, reporting suicidal ideation. So, you know, this is a patient that may present to the emergency room, make a statement that, you know, they're feeling suicidal, they're going to kill themselves, transferred over to our facility, and then we evaluate them. Most frequently, we end up evaluating them while they're sober, so they're blowing less than a 0.08, and then they say, you know, doctor, I'm really sorry, I said that when I was drunk, I didn't mean to, I'm not gonna kill myself, I do need counseling though. If you could hook me up with a counselor, that would be great. And so, you know, that tends to be a common presentation, and so, you know, that's kind of a very common situation. Yes.
So this is Matt Therapy. I have a question. Can you guys do an evaluation with someone that's intoxicated, or do you have to wait until they're sober?
We have to wait until they're sober. Yeah. A lot of the times they'll be housed in our facility while they're still intoxicated. So we do give them that safe space. but you know, to perform an appropriate psychiatric evaluation, they do need to be sober.
And it's a standard of practice thing. It's not a law.
Okay.
But it's the standard of, like, with the profession across the country.
To do an evaluation, make sure some of those.
Yeah, with the idea of like, if somebody's intoxicated, how reliable are they in what they're saying?
I'm always reliable.
I'm sure you are. Every time I talk to you, I think you're intoxicated.
Yeah.
The other issue is like, so let's say that you felt that they were reliable, right? So you did that interview, and then also, what do? Like, do you discharge them and allow them to get in their car and drive away with a BAL of 200? So there's some kind of some reliability and some kind of social ethics issues.
Interesting. Oh, I was just wondering, because when you said that, like, we take a lot of people that are intoxicated, say, in suicidal state.
Right. You know, it's important that they do be evaluated, because, you know, not every patient is going to be clear.
Right. And just to be clear, this doesn't mean that we say, oh, you're intoxicated, get out of here, we're not going to talk to you, right? We let them sit there until they metabolize and it goes right down. And also, if I may, so just to point out, there are two standards here. This is the psychiatry standard, which is to go based on the measurement. The medical emergency room standard is to not take a measurement and go based on the clinical evaluation of intoxication. And those standards are different, but the guidelines, that's how they are. So if somebody's in the medical ED, they might just, it will commonly not be based on the number, because, and they wrote those guidelines because they don't want them to sit there and wait forever. They say, we're clinicians, we can make a clinical judgment. Because in fact, somebody might, if somebody has really high tolerance, they might not be very intoxicated at a 0.1, right?
Right.
And somebody might be still plenty intoxicated at 0.07 if they have a low tolerance. So just two different standards, but they're both in the emergency setting. It's just like psych emergency versus medical emergency.
Interesting.
Sorry.
No, thank you. And a lot of the times, you know, what we can do is kind of evaluate the underlying cause too. You know, why are they drinking so heavily? Are they drinking? Is there an underlying anxiety disorder, an underlying schizophrenia, or other primary psychotic disorder that we're missing? So it is important to evaluate, you know, the etiology or why or where these symptoms are coming from. We already mentioned the 10-year-old with developmental delay, so I will skip over this one. So here's another pretty common one. A 55-year-old male, history of polysubstance use, found walking on tramway barefoot, urinary tox screen positive for opiates, benzodiazepines, and, you know, methamphetamines. And so this is, you know, this is somebody who, the presentation, you know, it kind of depends on how we see them when they present into PES. You know, they could be actively psychotic, screaming, spitting, banging on walls. They may have to go into restraints. They may be completely quiet, not talking. So this is a situation where, you know, a number of different presentations are possible. And so it kind of just depends on what we find while they're housed with us. But, you know, if their urinary tox screen is positive for, you know, any of these things, and, you know, their vital signs are unstable, you know, we're likely to send them over too. Or they may be positive for a number of these things and they may be completely stable and kind of saying that they're suicidal, or they're making kind of like vague statements that they're going to hurt people, with, you know, the perceived benefit of coming in and perhaps receiving, you know, food and housing and shelter and all of these things. So, most certainly taken on a case by case basis. Was there a question?
Okay. Hey everyone, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
I apologize. Yes. This is Captain Santos Garcia, Albuquerque Fire Department. I was, we had a structure fire, so I'm kind of late to the meeting, so I apologize.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. So moving right along here, you know, a 30-year-old female, history of Unspecified psychosis found outside a convenience store, passed out later, requiring 4-point restraint, spinning, punching, and cursing at staff. And so we may look at this presentation, we may look at, you know, the amount of antipsychotic required to kind of control the patient's behaviors, and then, you know, think to ourselves, this is a patient that really needs to come into the hospital if they're, you know, this psychotic, if they're needing to be restrained in the emergency department, if their urinary tox screen is negative, this is somebody that we would, you know, likely admit to the hospital. So 4 more cases here. We have the case of a 75-year-old female, a history of dementia with behavioral disturbances with dysuria or pain with urination, and an increase in aggression brought over from their assisted living facility. And this is a very common presentation. And you know, very frequently I will see a patient like this and immediately send them over to the medical emergency room, because in the elderly population, if you have these patients with behavioral changes, a lot of the times that's a manifestation of an underlying, you know, medical condition. So, you know, patients over, generally speaking, over the age of 65 with any behavioral disturbances, we're going to send kind of immediately to the emergency or to the medical emergency room for medical clearance, so that they can get basic lab drawn, a urine screen, you know, possibly get IV fluids. So very common presentation.
Can you explain like what the likely diagnosis here with this case is for folks?
Oh, yes, of course. So likely diagnosis being a urinary tract infection in this situation. Did you have anything else to add, Dr. Dewey?
This commonly will cause people with dementia to have way big changes in their behavior and stuff and act psychotic and agitated when really it's a urinary tract infection.
Very, very common presentation. You know, a patient that I saw in the emergency room a couple of weeks ago, a 40-year-old male, history of bipolar disorder, known history of bipolar disorder, you know, kicked off the Greyhound with erratic behaviors, singing to himself. You know. So we don't know really anything about this patient. He has an underlying psychiatric diagnosis. He's very frequently telling me that he's not, you know, taking medications. This is somebody that, you know, we would likely bring into the hospital. And here's another one, a 60-year-old male, history of diabetes.
I have a question. This is yes. The 40-year-old bipolar. Now, from the brief presentation, you get there's no clear dangers. So how do you articulate him getting into the hospital?
How do we formulate the case?
Yes.
That's a very good question. And so it depends on each patient's presentation. I think in this case, we allowed the patient to, we observed the patient for quite some time and kind of reevaluated him. And, you know, he was saying a lot of the times we'll end up with a patient with kind of co-occurring medical conditions too. So say they'll present with, you know, blood sugar of 600, to the emergency room, which is, you know, an indication that they may have like underlying medical conditions that are not being appropriately attended to. So that kind of illustrates the next case. But, you know, in the case of a young man who's not otherwise, you know, medically healthy, you know, it kind of depends on what, you know, collateral sources will tell us too. And so in this case, appropriate identification of collateral is important. So say some, we call the person's wife and they tell us, oh yeah, they've been missing for 2 weeks. I've been trying to get them in to see their psychiatrist. They refuse, you know, things of that nature. So they don't have, you know, rapid outpatient follow-up. They're completely denying that they have any sort of condition. In the past when he's been manic and we've let him go off, he's ended up hurting a lot of people. So it kind of depends on, you know, what each patient tells us and their collateral sources.
So in this case, you might be admitting him not because he's singing, but because you're afraid of what that also means.
Exactly. You know, this is the presentation that we'll see, but a lot of the times there's a great deal of detective work that's required.
Justin Trebatowski, APD. So a lot of times we hear from a law enforcement side, we bring this subject in and we know, like, we got to bring this subject in. What would be, I guess, tips from your perspective, what you need to hear from that law enforcement officer?
Great question.
With this subject?
Great question.
What do we need to hear? So very specific behaviors. How are they interacting? Were they agreeable to coming in for evaluation? Were they very resistant? Did they require hands-on? Any other specific?
I think your concerns, right? Mm-hmm. Especially safety concerns, right? Because you brought him to a hospital for some reason, or you picked him up for some reason, right? So, like, why is that? He was wandering into traffic, or, you know, he was swinging a 2x4 with nails at nobody, but there were like people kind of around, you know, whatever it is that's kind of tugging at your intuition, something is not safe here.
Yeah.
I think share your wisdom and experience, share your intuition. I mean, the docs are going to make their own call clinically, right?
Sure.
But that information is helpful because you saw them on the scene. So I think anything that you observed in the field that we don't have the ability to know, we would love to hear that.
Okay.
Right.
Absolutely. And the more specific, the better. So,
yeah,
especially when it comes to dangers, any comments they made, instead of saying, oh, this guy's suicidal, say he pointed his finger at his head like this and was going to make pantomime shooting. So that's much more valuable than, oh, he's suicidal.
Great example.
So anything that's very specific in those.
That's right. And just descriptive, like, you don't need to know clinical terms. You don't need to know any of the map medical language. It's really just your observations, right? This is what I saw.
Okay.
It doesn't need to be fancy at all.
And Matt's here with APD. Just to piggyback on Justin's question, you were talking about getting collateral information. Is there any collateral information that we should provide you?
If you can get phone numbers and things like that, it's very valuable.
And that to whom? Like friends and family, or just
yeah.
Who is it that
anybody who knows the person?
Anybody knows the person at their baseline, anybody especially. Close.
Okay, man.
Yeah, and, you know, kind of at their baseline, how are they in their normal, you know, day-to-day lives versus how they're presenting right now? Is there, you know, a considerable change? And so that's something that we pay, you know, very close attention to. How far are they from where they're normal?
Give a perfect example. The 40-year-old male history of bipolar kicked off the Greyhound. Let's say we called 3 or 4 collateral, and they said, oh, yeah, he's getting kicked off at every place. It's been like that for the last 10 years. He's just a jerk, and he's always singing and screaming. And that's just how he is. Probably much less likely to get admitted than, oh, he was a banker, he lived in New York, and he was, now all of a sudden he went off the radar, and what the hell's going on? Then he's going to get admitted.
Sorry, Justin, APDs. To follow up with that question, like Matt had mentioned, so we, as the field officer, we do get the call from the family member. They're not themselves, take them to the hospital.
Right.
So as the field officer, your typical response sometimes is, well, they're not suicidal, they're not a danger to themselves or others, I'm not taking them. Whereas if that collateral is able to articulate how they're degressing, would it be appropriate to bring that collateral's information almost immediately to the intake? So this is the wife, this is how she's articulating you know, her concerns. I didn't see it, but this is what they're saying.
For sure.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, that's very important information in terms of our documentation and, you know, reasons for bringing the patient into the hospital, perhaps involuntarily. We do have this source of information, you know, that provides evidence that the patient is, you know, a danger. So.
And that stuff ends up in court, too.
It does. Mm-hmm.
Does it have to have been brought up at that time to be in court, though?
At any time.
Okay.
Anytime before the
case. I just thought, but admission, it doesn't.
We can give you any information, right? Like,
yes.
If the patient's like, don't, you can't give them my mom's number. We can still be like, here's a mom's number.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And in fact,
we do it right in front of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
you
show your face.
They'll be upset about it, but.
Yeah, and then maybe.
And we also don't. Maybe they'll be admitted because they go
which,
home.
What's really helpful about giving us that information is that in an emergency situation, we don't need their permission.
That's what I was just going to ask, because if we give you this collateral information, like their roommate, their family.
Yeah.
Can you guys call, or is that considered a HIPAA violation?
No, because an emergency situation is an exception to HIPAA.
Okay.
And so they were very clear in writing HIPAA, we don't want this to get in the way of taking care of an emergency. And so HIPAA doesn't apply. It's an exception.
And it is like the only time that they can call. So that would be probably the best time to give that.
Yeah.
Here's all the information we collected.
Perfect. That stuff goes a long way from working at PDS on the other side. That stuff goes a long way.
And the patient's going to be resistant, but.
It's the dark side.
Is that sufficient information to take them, like go begin backing off of Justin if they, the wife calls and says, he's just acting abnormal. This isn't his typical behavior, but he's not being violent or making any kind of suicidal ideations. Is that still enough to take him in? He will be admitted, or do we still need some other underlying reason to take him?
The threshold for taking them in is actually lower than admitting. So if you have enough that you can say, I think he's dangerous, just anything, you can take them in. I mean, you're not just rounding people. Everybody, I mean, if you have enough that you think, I'm uncomfortable leaving this person, that's really enough.
Yeah.
And then it's up to the hospital to decide whether to admit them or not. That's a much higher level, and then they get a court date. So in terms of thresholds, for every 5 people that are brought, maybe only 2 are admitted.
But risk has to be there, right? So it's not like I wake up one day and my wife's like, this is not normally him just because like I'm in a mood or whatever. That's not enough, right? Right, yeah, I'd be taking every day. So it's really that there's a risk to self, a risk to others, or a potential risk because of this grave passive neglect, right?
Yeah.
So like if I'm so psychotic that I'm eating glass or something like that, right? Or I haven't eaten for 10 days. Please take me to a hospital. I haven't said I'm going to kill myself. I might say I want to live, and I haven't threatened anybody else. But my thinking is getting in the way of it's posing a risk to me, even kind of passively.
The hospital has an admission bias, in my opinion, towards first break, psychosis, and mania. So if there's a kid that's just like 18, 22, something manic out of their head. 3 weeks ago, they were sort of an upright citizen doing great. Even if you can't see something that's clearly dangerous, you know, mania untreated, you can make an argument that is dangerous. And then it's up to the hospital to figure out a way if they need to be admitted. And that's why that case I keyed in on, because that is the kind of case that they want to admit. Those are the people who benefit most from the hospital. And are at greatest risk from not being in the hospital. So they figure out a way to justify the admission.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Another example, so like in PES, there was this young lady, she was probably like 25, 26, and so psychotic. She was just like, she was so disorganized that she couldn't even make sense when she spoke. And she was living out on the streets, right? She wasn't threatening to hurt herself or anybody else. She was eating, stuff like that. She was clothed. But my concern was, she's so psychotic. Like, her thinking is so disorganized that she is totally at risk of being taken advantage of on the street, and like a very real risk, right? Young, attractive young lady. We hospitalized her because we were afraid of discharging her in that state. So we at least wanted to kind of give her the benefit of the doubt of seeing if we could treat her psychosis and get her thinking better, and just enough better that she could kind of protect herself on the street, right? We couldn't, you know, materialize housing or anything like that, but at least put her in a better position for her own safety, even though nobody had threatened yet. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. But we thought, like,
why wait?
This whole law, these statutes are really about protecting people and society. Mm-hmm. And that's a clinical judgment, right? Like a case like that.
Yeah, I just wasn't sure just as far as where we draw the line of violating their rights. And
exactly. And it's a tough balance. Yeah. And it's one that we take very, very seriously.
And kind of like on the flip side, say you have like a 16-year-old female living at home with her parents, and she's demonstrating kind of like these similar psychotic episodes, but she's in a safe space.
Right.
Parents can, you know, take her to an outpatient appointment. That's somebody who we would be, you know, least likely to admit.
Yeah,
because
it's today, right? I'm only Justin today.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. It's really is case by case.
We should bring it up after this.
Okay.
I'm just saying, we would do that. That's it.
Are you segueing? Is that what's happening?
No.
So, I mean, that's pretty much, I can flip through, kind of back to this, very last case, a 50-year-old female history of, bipolar disorder, type 2, borderline personality disorder, multiple suicide attempts by overdose, reporting that she ingested a handful of pills in the setting of, partner conflict. And this is, kind of what Dr. Rosenbaum had alluded to before, the case of somebody with an underlying personality disorder who maybe, it kind of depends on the severity of the attempt as well. So say she took in about, four melatonin pills and, she got into an argument with her husband and she's saying that she wants to kill herself, versus somebody who's taking, two bottles of benzodiazepines and drank a bunch of alcohol, kind of looking at the severity of the attempt and, keying into those other risk factors as well, just kind of one last important point to hone in on. That is all I have. So I thank you all for your attention and your interest.